This man is a special friend to me. I've had some real fun in sobriety with this man. We've done some good things together. Done some conventions, done some rafting trips. I've also got to know him as to be a person that can listen to me and I can listen to him. We can share our feelings with each other. I understand that in about 3 weeks he's got 1 year coming up. And on that one, I'd like to give you my good buddy over here, Roy. I'm Roy, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm nervous. Yeah, I know. I like to say welcome to the newcomers, you know. If, like they say, if you're in these rooms, you didn't get here by accident, you know. So stick around and listen. What it was like out there. Well, I go way back. My earliest childhood memories are when I was 2 and 3 years old, of having their memories of having my hands tied behind my back and being beat by my mother. That's my earliest memories. And from there on, they don't get much better for years. You know, we were, due to circumstances, we were a very poor family. We were on welfare in 1949 and 1950 here in the Valley. And it isn't like it is today. Today it's a prestige trip, you know. Back then it wasn't. And I wasn't raised either. I was, from the time I was about 7 years old on, my older brother and I kind of mostly raised ourselves. And I wasn't taught morals. I wasn't taught honesty. I wasn't taught anything. Anything I learned out on the streets. So that gave me a real good foundation for when I got older and started having to deal with life, you know. I didn't drink. I had uncles at down here at St. James Park. I had uncles that were winos, down and out trench coat type winos. And I always used to say, I'm never going to be like those people. I'm never going to drink, you know. And I didn't all through high school and everything like that. I didn't drink. But then I went to the Navy when I was 17, almost 18. That's where I started drinking. And I know today that I started drinking alcoholically right from the very first time I drank. I don't remember my first drink. I've tried to really think about it, and I don't remember. But I was always in trouble in the Navy. I was one of those guys that would get a 72 or a 48 or even a one-night pass, and I'd go out and I'd, you know, the countries I went to and the places I went, the only thing I knew about them was the bars. And I'd forget to go back to the ship, you know, and I was always on restriction, so I saved a lot of money to go out and get drunk when I got off restriction, you know. But anyhow, I went through the Navy and come out of there, and for some reason, I don't know why, I've thought about it, and I really don't know why, but for some reason, from the time I was 21 to the time I was 29, I really didn't drink that much. I went through three marriages in that period, and none of my wives drank. None of them drank. If they had one drink a year, that was heavy drinking for them. And so consequently, I didn't drink. If I drank a six-pack of beer a week, that was heavy drinking. I didn't do any dope either. And then when I was 29, I was separated from my third wife. And today I know that just because I wasn't drinking, I still had alcoholic thinking, or I wouldn't have had three wives, you know. And when I was 29, I met an alcoholic, a female alcoholic. And we started living I met her in a bar one night. I took her home with me and I kept her, you know. She was my kind of woman, I'll tell you. But that's when I really started drinking, really alcoholically. From when I was 21 to 29, I didn't. And I met her, and we got a little apartment over here, and started drinking. The bar we drank in was a block from the apartment, so that was real good, you know. We didn't have to drive home. And we drank and we fought for 7 or 8 or 9 years. I don't remember. 8 years, I guess. I mean, we did everything that two alcoholics can do to each other that you could possibly think of. You know, in every department, we were bankrupt, you know, both of us. We beat each other up. We cheated on each other. We did the whole nine yards, you know. And I always knew that she was an alcoholic. I always knew that. I used to beat her up and tell her she was an alcoholic, you know. But I never considered myself an alcoholic. I was just a heavy-duty partier. You know, I partied every day. I drank and did dope every day. But just to show you, you know, how an alcoholic is addictive, I never did any dope till I was 25 years old. I made a mistake a while ago. I started doing dope when I was 25. And I never did any. And I smoked a joint one night, and I dug it. And I got up the next morning and I dropped a hit of acid. And I was on my way, you know. Immediately I left that wife that day. I quit my job that day. I made a vow to quit shaving and quit getting haircuts and quit wearing good clothes. That very day I turned into a hippie, you know what I mean? And I went that way till I got on the program a year and a half ago. But anyhow, where was I? I completely forgot. But anyhow, with this woman, I used to tell her she was an alcoholic, and I never considered myself an alcoholic, you know. And then through a long series of events, we lived in Northern California in the wilderness up there and back in the woods, you know, no toilets, no running water, no electricity. And through a series of events, she finally left me so she could try to get her life together and quit drinking. And she ended up, after a few years here in San Jose, she got in the program of AA. And then I came back to San Jose, and I wanted to get back with her. So I told her, you know, hell, I'll go to AA too, you know. But I came here, and I didn't want to stop drinking, you know. Hell no. And so I started coming to the AA and coming to these meetings and listening, and I could see myself in everybody I heard and everybody I'd seen. And by then I knew, after a few meetings, and I bought a big book and I read it, and she was always giving me these pamphlets, and I took the test and I passed it, you know. But I knew I was alcoholic, but I didn't want to stop drinking and doping, you know. Because I didn't know that there was another way to live. I didn't know that I didn't have to do the things that I was doing. And so finally, after 7 months of that and going through Montevilla Hospital and all that, everything I learned there and everything, I went out on my last drunk. And I was the kind of guy that, you know, if there was a party, I was the last one to leave it. I was the kind of guy that no matter what I drank, no matter what kind of dope I did, I rarely passed out. It was rare that I passed out. I was the guy that drove other people home. I was the guy that was drinking the last beer or smoking the last joint. I was the last one up at almost all parties, and I closed the bars every night. And, you know, I could hold my own with the best of them. And my last drunk taught me. drank about equivalent of a six pack of beer and probably hits off of four or five joints, which was nothing, you know. That was before breakfast type stuff, you know. That was to get you going in the morning. And I blacked out that night. I don't know how I got home. I know I went to a restaurant and ate because it was on me the next day, you know. But it was either the next day, that was the day before Mother's Day last year, and it was either a couple of days later, I really don't remember, that I asked a guy to be my sponsor, and he's still my sponsor today. I haven't had the need to change sponsors. I started working the steps. I got a higher power in my life. I realized months before that there was a God. I never had a God. I believed in him, but I believed he was the guy that caused famines and little kids to have polio and babies to be born deformed. That's what he did. He didn't do any good trips, you know. He just did bad stuff. But then I got a God in my life, and I started working the steps, I didn't realize it at the time, but when I took my third step with my sponsor, and it was the first time in my whole life that I ever prayed. It was the first time I ever prayed. And I didn't know it immediately, but I realized it about a week later that God had removed the obsession for alcohol from me. I hadn't been thinking about it for a whole week, you know, and it blew my mind. And so I was still living in a lot of pain, almost physical, of the things that I did. And he removed that from me. And I did my fourth and my fifth. And I did a step one in Montevilla. And I cried, you know. And I let all this stuff out. And I don't walk around with that pain anymore. I don't hurt no more. I feel good about myself today. People say they like their self today. That's hard for me to say that I like myself, but I'm comfortable in my skin. My attitudes are changing. I don't treat people the same. I don't get in fights and I don't get in arguments. I can go in restaurants and have a meal without getting in an argument today. I can go in a store and go shopping. I can drive down the freeway. I can do my job. I can walk through life today without getting upset and mad at people. And through the process of those steps and the people in these rooms and the program, my whole life has changed. You know, I go to meetings every day. I'm like my sponsor. He's the first one I heard say this, and this is the way I do it. He says he gets up in the morning and he starts his day and he goes through what he has to do during that day with one aim, and that's to get an AA meeting in somewhere in that day or at the end of that day. And I was one of those people that when they told me 90 meetings in 90 days, I said, aha, bullshit. I got things to do. I can't be going to this AA trip all the time, you know. Well, today, if I go through a 24-hour period and I don't have an AA meeting and I don't see my people, and there's certain people that I look forward to seeing every day. There's certain people that I love. I love every one of you, but there's certain people that I have grown to love with a special love and a special caring. And if I don't see them people every day, it was like when I was a little kid and I didn't see my parents every day. I miss them. I need these rooms in my life. I need this program, and I don't think I've ever said it before, but I'll say it right now tonight. I am grateful for what I had to do to get to where I'm at today, to get to these rooms and you people. I'm very grateful. And it's only been about a month that I have felt that way. It's only been about a month that I sat down with my ex-wife, and we talked, and I finally realized that I don't have to feel guilty for what I did, because I had to do what I did, and she had to do what she did, and that's where I'm at today, and I think the time's about up. Thank you.
This is our main speaker for this evening.
From what I understand, this gentleman has a little over 21 years of sobriety. He also left me his credentials up here, which I thought you might be interested in seeing. This man's been well enough to come to us all the way from Mountain View, and with that, I would like to give you Curly F.
Thank you very much. My name is Curly Farrar, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Curly.
You rarely hear one hesitate on that F. I haven't gone by Curly F for 21 years. It's a hell of a poor time to be starting now. I'm very pleased to be down here and talk with you about Alcoholics Anonymous. First of all, let me congratulate the new people, the ones that got their chips, ones who are just coming in. This could be the greatest start of your life if you're brand new. Great things will happen for you. And you can depend on that because they have for me for over 21 years. I took my last drink on the 28th day of January, 1962, and it hasn't been necessary to take a drink or any chemical since that time. I'm real pleased with that myself. I told my wife, I said, by God, I'm 21 now, I can drink. She says, yes, and you're just old enough to know better. If I stay sober for 21 more years, she's going to let me have a short beer. If you believe that, you look at her and see the look on her face when I say that. I didn't come down here to try to impress you with what a big, bad old drunk I am. I'm sure, though, that all of you have probably glanced at the 20 questions once or twice over your careers here. One question in there says, do you seek the company of lower companions when drinking? I was the one you was looking for. I've had a lot of fun in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can think of no better way for a man to get well than to start laughing again. And humor, when it returns, is a great asset to any of us in staying sober. Because my sponsor, God rest his soul, he liked to tell jokes and he passed them down to me. Glenn Christensen, who's a great man. Had he stayed sober, he would have been sober 36 years this year, in June. But he passed on. Now my wife's my sponsor. And God, she rules me with an iron hand, too, I'll tell you that. She don't let me get astray. Glenn told a story about how weird alcoholics are. This one guy was confined in a mental institution. He was to go up to be released, and you have to go before a board of psychiatrists, you know, to get out of them joints. And so he went up there, and the chairman of the board says, well, young man, what are you going to do when you get out of here? The guy being a drunk, you know, he says, oh, hell, I don't know. I'm gonna get me some elastic, make me a slingshot, and break every damn window in this nut house. The chairman says, you go on back to ward. You'll stay here a while. So he went back to ward and was talking to his buddy. He said, I'm not getting out. And he had told his buddy, why? But he says, you can't tell them people things like that. You'll never get out of here. So he was there 3 months and went back for the board again. The chairman says, what are you going to do when you get out of here? Guy, he wised up a little. He said, oh, I'm going down here and I'm going to get me a good job. I'm going to make me a lot of money. I'm going to buy me a great big red convertible. I'm going to find me a blonde-headed doll. Take that blonde-headed doll and take a ride out in the country. And that convertible, he says, take a blanket out of the car and throw it out under the shade trees. I'm going to get that blonde on that blanket. I'm going to throw her down, take off her panties, and take the elastic out of the waistband, make me a slingshot, and break every damn window. So he went back to the ward. I drank for about 35 years. And I tried to drink as much of that time as I could. Of course, you know, things prevent us drinking 24 hours, like passing out, getting so sick and puking that you can't, it's all coming up and you can't get any down, all them sort of things. But I tried as best I could to drink continuously. And it damn near killed me, and it should have. The 21 years that I have here is on borrowed time because I shouldn't have gotten here in the first place. I should have been dead. And I say, too, in Alcoholics Anonymous, the only things I didn't do were go to the penitentiary or kill somebody, but I would have. I was almost in the penitentiary, and I almost killed people. But it so happens that I didn't. Those are the two things, the two fates that I didn't have to go through. But I went through a lot of other things that, at the time, were bad. I don't know that I liked them too well, but I didn't have sense enough to know what the problem was. It was a case of denial all the way down the line. I wasn't an alcoholic. I could quit any time I wanted to. And I spent 35 years proving that I could stop when I wanted to. But I never got to that point. So I had to keep on drinking and follow the path that I did. In 19 years' time, from 1943 until 1962, I was confined in 65 hospitals, institutions, sanitariums, fidget farms, drying out joints. I was cured four times and drank 11 years to prove it. I went to hypnotists. I went to everything. And my wife sent me to everything. She's the one that was confining me in nut houses and telling me, "Oh, Curly, I had to put you in there because I loved you." Hell, I could have done less love and more hate at the rate I was going. Because you take 19 years, 65 joints, you're not walking on the street too much. And in between times, they were throwing me in jail for being a common drunk. And that was an insult to my integrity. Not a damn thing common about me. I was high class. You know, I was sleeping under the bridge with whiskers all over my face and wrapping myself up in gunny sacks. But by God, I was reading the stock market page. That's kind of what you'd call a silk sheet drunk. But my health started getting bad after a while when I continued to drink. I couldn't stand it too well because I wouldn't eat and I'd become dehydrated. And I'd have to go into these hospitals, you see, so they could feed me intravenously because I couldn't eat for 2 or 3 weeks after they'd get the booze out of my system. I couldn't keep anything on my stomach. I know people say that drunks are hopeless, helpless beings. Well, I didn't turn out that I was hopeless, but helpless, yeah, I know what they're talking about. Have you ever laid on your back and puking straight up and couldn't roll over? You're helpless. And you can't do anything about it. And you don't want to do anything about it. And you could care less what people say about it. And that's the route I took. I had to. The only way I could exist was to drink. And that's all it is out there, is an existence. God forbid anybody having to leave Alcoholics Anonymous and go back out there again. I can get drunk anytime I want to, of course. Anytime I want to, I can get drunk. But God, that sobering up is what worries me. I don't know whether I could ever sober up again. That's the tough part. Any of us, it's easy to get drunk. All you got to do is take one drink and you're off and running if you're an alcoholic like I am. Of course, alcoholics are dummies, you know it? They are. They're real dumb. Take a story about the guy that was up giving the Alcoholics Anonymous pitch. And he said, animals, he says, are smarter than people. He says, you get a mule up here, and if he's been sick on whiskey, and you take him over to a barrel of whiskey and a barrel of water, he's going to drink the water. Now, why do you suppose that is? A little wino in the back of the room jumped up and said, because he's a jackass. That's what we are, jackasses, because we continue to drink after we know what our problem is. That isn't the way to go. Take the advice of some of these people you hear talking to Alcoholics Anonymous, if you will. Because they have found a way through Alcoholics Anonymous to go one day at a time without taking one drink right now. The greatest program that was ever brought about, and the greatest way for an alcoholic to live, is to live this life of Alcoholics Anonymous in your daily life each and every day. Now, when I started out, I don't know whether or not I was alcoholic. I drank as much as I could every time I took a drink, but I don't know whether I started out as an alcoholic or not, whether I was born one or whether I created it. I hope I was born one, because if I didn't, I wasted a hell of a lot of time developing it. Believe me, I worked at that hard. And, you know, I have found out, too, that it's a hell of a lot easier to stay sober than it is to get sober again. Man, I can't stress that enough, how tough that getting sober is. You know, you've been there if you're alcoholic. And you gotta think so hard all the time. You gotta plan your next move very carefully about where your next jug's coming from, where you're gonna drop your next hot piece of paper. You know them checks? Hell, in my early years, I didn't know you had to have money in the bank to write checks. I just wrote them everywhere. I was quite an accomplished paper hanger. In fact, that's my almost to the penitentiary was because I got tired of writing my own name on them checks, so I put somebody else's name on them. And they had me in the Cheyenne County Jail in 1937 for forgery. And I'm looking at 2 to 10 because I had out about $3,000 or $4,000 worth of checks. That was a lot of money in them days. Because I'd gotten into one of my bad habits, I got drunk and got to gambling. I probably would have turned out to be a professional gambler, except that I got drunk and lost all the time. That's all that held me back. I left Wyoming, come to West Coast, got out into San Diego. That's a beautiful town. I went into a good racket for a drunk. I went into the card dealing business. Work in the card room, go over to T-Town every night, get drunk, come back across and go to work. Day and night, drinking and playing cards. And this was in 1941. And I got all tanked up one day and got to waving the flag around, you know, about in December when the Japanese hit Pearl Harbor. And I was walking down the street drunk, waving this flag, and I staggered into a U.S. Marine Corps recruiting depot. That's where I made my first mistake. And they made their first mistake. They took me. So I went to a very rigorous training session and come back in. I was assigned to Camp Elliott, San Diego. And then they made their second mistake. They gave me liberty. Overnight liberty. 89 days later, they found me in a card room downtown San Diego. And I had been declared a deserter and was up for a general court-martial before I even got overseas. And this was in 42, I guess. I started serving time. I finally got a smart lawyer, a first lieutenant, and got the charge dropped to a summary court-martial. And all I got out of was a $150 fine and 6 months in the brig. So I started off my Marine Corps in the brig. And was doing great because at that time I was a little older and looked a little more mature than most of the young fellows that were coming in at that time. And so I took charge immediately in the brig. And I had my own bunk over in the corner. I got all special food. I could smoke anytime I wanted to. And all these great things, the liberties that you have. I was coxswain of the brig. And all the special privileges. And after I'd been in there a little bit, well, I got real special privileges. I got to go out and drink beer with the sergeant of the guard. Well, that's right down my alley, you know, and it worked good for a little while, till one night I'm sitting out there with my feet up on the desk and swigging on a beer, and the officer of the day come by. Man, I'm in deep trouble. I know it. And it wasn't but about 3 days later I was shipped for South Pacific. And I went on a big ship. It was the Lure Line out of San Francisco. It was a pleasure ship, and they put it in as the troop ship in World War II. So they stuck me on that Lure Line. And the first night out, I made a great discovery. I found the hole that had the medicinal brandy in it. And boy, that was right down my alley. I had a nose, you know. I smelled it through the deck. I don't know how I got to it, but I went through it like a bird dog. Now that comes in 10th pints is what it is, and then it comes in cartons, and then it comes in cases. I haven't the slightest idea of how many of those cases I stole. But I had those 10th pints of brandy stashed from stem to stern on that lure line. Because if I fell down drunk, I wanted to reach out and get a belt. And just had a pleasure cruise across. I'll tell you, I had more fun than you can shake a stick at. I made a lot of money, too. I was gambling, throwing dice, playing cards. And we got into New Hebrides, and the scuttlebutt on the ship was that they were going to transfer ships. And I thought, oh, my God, all my brandy stashed all over this thing. You know, I had to work 72 straight hours to find all that damn brandy I had stashed away. But I found it and got it over on the other ship that we were going to take into Guadalcanal. And when I went over the side at Guadalcanal, I had thrown all my gear away, and I had a sea bag full of brandy and a gun on my hip and a Browning automatic rifle, and that's the extent of my belongings. So we went into the island. I wasn't any really great hero in the world, in the war, I'll tell you. Still in all, I was on that island. I had to make the best of it, so I stayed drunk on my brandy as long as I could, and then I started manufacturing some, stealing some, and talked to fly boys, and they brought in some. And I stayed drunk a lot on there, so you know I was getting in a lot of trouble. And they don't court-martial you down there. They just give you extra duty. And hell, they had me walking guard duty around the command post. Now, down in those islands, they've got them tree lizards, you know. They're about that long. They scurry like hell to make a lot of noise at night. Well, if you take a few drinks and hear some of that scurrying out there, them damn things grow. And if you ever saw a drunken Marine freeze on the trigger of a Browning automatic rifle, you know there's some noise going on. And so pretty soon, you know, they got kind of tired of all my shenanigans down there, so they decided they better get rid of me. They didn't know whose side I was on. So I got into trouble when I got into the ship that was taking me out of there. Went into Melbourne, Australia. I went over the hill there, and they had a hell of a time finding me. And they were leaving the next day, and they couldn't find me, and they held up the ship for a little while, and then they weren't going to hold up anymore, and they finally found me drunk downtown Melbourne, and we went on, or in Sydney, that was, and they took me on into Melbourne, and we were bivouacked at the Melbourne cricket grounds. And I got out there, and malaria came back on me after I'd been downtown 3 or 4 days getting drunk. And with that malaria, they took me up and put me in the 4th Army General Hospital in Melbourne, Australia. Now, that was my first hospitalization. It was in January, I think it was January 1943. And I went over the hill from the hospital. I jumped the malaria quarantine, went downtown, got drunk, was gone for I don't know how many days. So when I come back, they stuck me in the psycho ward. Now, that was my first psycho ward in that 4th Army General Hospital. And before they threw me in there, I talked them into letting me go down to the commissary, the canteen, and I bought a case of Aquavelva. And I said, I've got to shave. I got a heavy beard. So I took that case in this psych ward with me, and they started giving me medication to sober me up. And they couldn't figure out after 2 weeks why I hadn't sobered up yet. Because I'm drinking that Aquavelva and taking them pills, and I'm flying around there a little loose. They really thought I shaved a lot because I smelled so sweet. I was always making mistakes, too. There was a very competent Army major in there. He said, well, Mr. Farrar, I think you have acute alcoholism. And I misunderstood him. I thought he said I was acute alcoholic. Mistakes were prevalent in my career, I'll tell you. Hell, the first step, I thought it said we admitted we were alcoholic. My wife was unmanageable. Well, she couldn't very well be because I'd lost her. I don't know where the hell she was. I'd lost her years before. Didn't even have the slightest idea where she was. And she didn't know she had a husband over there winning the war. And it's a good thing she didn't. But God love her. She's been a great asset to my program and has been a big part of it continuously from the time I came in here. Of course, she was the one that was always throwing me in the nut houses, but she was always coming to my rescue, too. She was not only trying to save my life, she was trying to save the life of other people. because I never knew what was going to happen. Would you believe that I was driving taxi cabs under the influence and taking pills at the same time, drinking turpentine and codeine, and taking Secanol, Tylenol, Nembutal, anything I could get my hands on? And by the time I got stopped, I not only was I drinking booze, but I was taking all kinds of sleeping pills during the day, and I was also taking turpentine and codeine for my cough. I have bronchitis, you know. So I had to take 8 4-ounce bottles of turpentine and codeine per day to stop my bronchitis. Didn't do a damn thing for my cough, but I didn't know I was coughing. I discovered that cough syrup while I was in the Marine Corps. We called it white lightning. I drank a lot of it in there, too. But everything I could get a hold of, the man that was talking up here before me, he was talking about marijuana. You know, I had a round with that marijuana, too. That was back in my early days. But I smoked a few joints, and I'd get to laughing, you know. And I didn't know what the hell I was laughing about. And I felt so odd, I thought, well, maybe I hadn't better use that stuff anymore. So I got away from pot at that time, but then I got into pills and all the rest of this crap that you have to take as a result. And then I found out about some of these great tranquilizers while I was cured 4 times. I found out about them. I took the aversion treatment in Shadles in Seattle, twice up there and then twice over in Spokane, the same kind of a joint. They try to make you so sick on booze that you won't drink it anymore, you know. And Haley got me in there, and I'm in for the first 17-day cure, and they were trying to make me sick, and they couldn't make me vomit. So they'd take that hose, you know, and wrap it down my throat. I'd laugh at them. I said, hell, I've been sicker out in the alley than what you're making me in here. And then they'd put you on sodium pentothal and try to find out what you did while you was a kid, you know, that caused you to drink. And they didn't get my pentothal quite deep enough due to my, I was able to tolerate this pentothal, I'll say. And they didn't get me quite deep enough. I had all the answers made up before they asked the questions. And pretty soon after on the fourth time that I went in, which was in Spokane, they said, Mr. Farrar, we're not going to give you the aversion treatment. I see from your records that it don't do much good. And I said, oh, yeah, I have a good time. They said, that's why you're not going to get it. You go in them joints, you know, and of course you're a big shot when you go in. They say, well, what do you ordinarily drink while you're out there drinking? I said, oh, Canadian Club or Four Roses, Old Crow, something like that. So they'd give me Muscatel, warm Muscatel, hot gin, warm beer, and all them there things. Then they'd give you some salt water. And then they'd give you some Ipecac to induce vomiting. All those cute little tricks they had, but it didn't make any impression on me. After those 4 cures, I drank 11 more years before I was cured. I wound up in various places. I was a traveling drunk. Many times I'd get to, oh, hell, I'd go maybe 5 or 10 miles a day. All depends on how many bars there were in between stops. But I got up in the Northwest, and I could always go to work if I could stay sober long enough. You see, because I was a plumber by trade, and I could drop my ticket in the local, and they'd send me out. So I didn't get sober enough. My father and mother actually picked me up out of my second sanitarium in Denver, Colorado, after I was discharged from the service. I got a little out of line there. I dropped off my service career before I was ready. I'll go back to that right now, and then we'll progress a little further. They sent me back to the States. Finally, they court-martialed me out of the Army Hospital in Melbourne, sent me back to the States into Vallejo, and stuck me in the brig in Vallejo because I got out of line coming back across the pond. And I got in the bar and got drunk, so they threw me in the brig on the ship, and then they threw me in the brig at Mare Island when I got back. And I went over the hill from there, and they finally decided that I wasn't too sane. So they sent me up to Napa. The Navy had a wing up there, and they put me up there until I was discharged as an undesirable, unfit for further foreign service, and not to be re-enlisted in the Marine Corps. So they got rid of me for good. But when I was discharged from Vallejo, then I took off on a running drunk, and I wound up in Denver, Colorado. In my, I said it was the first sanitarium I'd been in Denver, because I got drunk for about 3 months, and was dehydrated, and they put me in there because I was about to die. And my folks were up in Washington working on the atomic energy project up there, and my mother and father came down and bailed me out of the sanitarium and took me up to Richland, Hanford, Washington, and kept me sober long enough to drop my ticket in the local up there, and I went out on the project as a plumber. Well, I did stay sober to start with there for a little while, and of course, I was a good mechanic if you could catch me sober. And I worked for about, maybe a couple of months, and I was promoted to foreman, and then I was promoted to general foreman. And for that period of time, I wasn't really drinking that heavy. I was able to handle a few drinks once in a while, but not too well, because you could never tell when it was going to take over and I was going to wind up gone. And that happened on and off for 11 years up there, that I was in and out of that atomic energy plant. And I was in and out of hospitals up there. That was during the time that I was in Shadles. I was in Spokane. And I finally ran out of hospitals up there. By the time it come around to 1958, I couldn't get in a hospital in the whole northwest part of the country. And I couldn't drive a car because all my licenses had been taken. I'd gotten licenses in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Montana, and the cops had them all. The only license that I had was the permit to drive on the atomic energy compound from the Atomic Energy Commission. It was the only driver's license I had. So not being able to get into hospitals, I couldn't get well right away, you see, and that was kind of bad. So I decided I better leave there. And I took off, and I started back for California. But I got waylaid. I got waylaid. After the first few miles, I wound up in Pendleton, Oregon, and got drunk, and I was doing a little gambling. And I won a lot of money, so I stayed until midnight or when the card room closed, and then I started on down the road. But I got too drunk by the time I got to the Dalles, Oregon, and I had to stop because I couldn't even see the road. And so I went into this hospital, and I said, I've been drinking too much, and I'm a hazard on the road. I said, I'd like to check in here for a few days so you could sober me up. And this nice young doctor in the admitting room, he says, well, how do they usually sober you up? And I said, they give me an ounce of formaldehyde every hour. And if you know anything about formaldehyde, you'll know how damn crazy that is. They don't give you but very little, and they don't give it to you only every 4 hours at the least. And so inside of a couple of days' time, he had me walking upside down on the ceiling in the hospital. Next lucid moment I had, I looked at, they had me strapped down, they had the rails on the bed, and they had me in a love jacket, spread eagle. And here's a very austere-looking gentleman at the foot of the bed in a nice black suit, and he had a nice necktie on, and he had some guy with him. Turned out that it was a judge and the prosecuting attorney. And they said, we commit you, Mr. Farrar, to Eastern Oregon State Hospital. I said, you can't do that. I'm not even a resident of the state. They said, you are now. So they sent me to Eastern Oregon State Hospital. I had to stay there for 30 days. God, they gave me a spinal to find out whether I was nuts or not. They gave me shock treatments. They gave me the water treatment. They gave me everything I could think of, and filled me full of pills. But they couldn't find out that there was anything wrong with me mentally. And then, too, by this time, I had known about Alcoholics Anonymous prior to this, and I knew about the book. They had meetings there. So phony me, I go to them meetings, and get up there and tell them all about Alcoholics Anonymous and how I'm going to save the world because I'm a member, and quote from them the book, they thought I was really a great man in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd been to about two or three meetings, I guess, over 10 years. But anyway, I got out of there and I took off on down the coast, and I wound up going into San Jose. And reminding you now that I still don't have a driver's license, but I'm down there, and I dropped my ticket in San Jose, and they sent me out to work in Mountain View. So I'm working on a housing compound out there, and I'm living in San Jose. And one night, I didn't get too loaded. And I had always, during my life, I'd loved to dance. Man, I used to dance all and go to dances every night back in my home country in Wyoming. But this one night, I felt like dancing some, and I went up to this joint over on, it was down on Santa Clara, and it was upstairs, a nice ballroom up there. And I'd usually go into these ballrooms, you know, and look around and pick out the best dancers, and then I'd go ask them if they'd dance with me, you know. That is, before I got too drunk. And so I'm up there and watching, and man, I see a doll out there on the dance floor, and she was really tripping the light fantastic. And so I thought, well, I'll slip over and ask her for a dance pretty quick. I walked over and walked up behind her. I couldn't see what she looked like. But I got up there and tapped her on the shoulder. And I said, may I have this dance? And she turned around, and good God, it was my wife. I hadn't seen her for 20 years. But she said, I'd love to. And she didn't really, at that time, she still didn't know a great lot about alcohol, you know. She hadn't come to a conclusion when we'd gone. I think probably she sent me out with the garbage and I was gone for 20 years is what happened. But anyway, we started talking, and I found out that she was living in Mountain View. And I said, hell, I'm working out in Mountain View. And she said, who are you working for? And I told her this plumbing outfit in Mountain View. And she said, well, I'm working up in Palo Alto, just the other side of Mountain View. And I said, well, I have to drive from San Jose, clear out there every day. And she said, well, or I don't know, maybe I suggested moving out there, you know. I'd get together and save me some gas and save time, travel and so forth. And then with her income, it'd keep us in manner to which I was accustomed to living. So we wound up finally getting back together and started living in Mountain View. Now, that was in 1958, in October. And by December of 1958, I'm in Agnew for the first time. It was just before Christmas. I always managed to get into them joints during or before Christmas. I don't know of any time in my drinking career that I wasn't in hospitals over Christmas. People in AA, you hear them worrying about Christmas, you know, Christmas and New Year's. That's the period they're afraid of. Hell, I worried about the time from New Year's till Christmas. That was my trouble time. Anyway, between 58 and 1962, I was in Agnew five times. And varying lengths of time. I talked her into getting me out the first time. After a short period. The second time I got out a little longer period. The third time I was in there a little longer yet. The fourth time, I think I was in there almost 35 or 40 days. But the fifth time, I couldn't talk her into getting me out. Now this fifth time, the way I got in there was rather unusual. Because by this time I had quit plumbing and I'd gone to work for the City of Mountain View in the water division. And I got a check on 20th of December, 1961. And it was a pretty good sized check. Not as big as the money that I'd made plumbing, but nevertheless, for me at that time, I hadn't been making a hell of a lot of money anyplace. Because when working and drinking interfered with each other, I'd just quit. Not drinking, working. And so on 20th of December, I took off with this check. And in 5 days' time, I made 3 jails in Agnew State Hospital. In 5 days, you say, well, what the hell about it? One jail was in Elko, Nevada. The next one was in Cheyenne, Wyoming. The next one was back in Oakland on Christmas Eve. I got a kick out Christmas morning, and Christmas night I'm in Agnew for the fifth time. And on the 26th day of December, 1961, this was my admittance picture. You can take a close look at this after the meeting if you'd like to. I went out years later, and the superintendent out there They had it on the corner of my jacket, just a little square picture. I asked him if I might have that because I'd seen it and I thought it looked pretty. And he said, well, by this time, he says, they've probably got it down in the deep trees. And I said, well, I certainly would like to have that picture to remind me of what I went through. So he went down and got that out for me and gave it to me. Took it right off my old jacket out there, and I had that blown up. My wife said the only thing she regrets is that it wasn't in color, because that black and pink and purple that was on there would have really made a good picture, you know. I've shown that around to some meetings, and they say, hell, you're better looking than you are now. But that was why they called me. I did have some hair that when they called me Curly. I've had that for a long time, that nickname. But now this last time out there, some people in Santa Clara Valley had been calling on me between 58 and 62 and trying to get me into Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife, God love her, she just went all out to try to get me into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. She had everybody calling on me. She tried getting different people, you know, thought they might have some kind of benefit. But I wouldn't listen to a damn one of them. I think the reason was for that the first man that called on me in Santa Clara Valley was a damn steam fitter. And you know the animosity that exists between steam fitters and plumbers. I was a plumber and he was a steam fitter, and I sure as hell wasn't going to listen to anything he had to say. And I damn near died by getting away from him. But they kept trying. And she'd drag me to them meetings. God, how she'd drag me to meeting every night. And, of course, I'm sitting there with about a half bombed out with cough syrup most of the time at the meeting, so they couldn't smell liquor on my breath. So I'd be wobbling around, you know, and sitting there spilling coffee, burning my finger and dropping everything on the floor. And the chairman did not dare say, does anyone want to say something? Because my hand would go up. And I'd get up there and give them the damnedest pitch you ever heard. And here I am so drunk I can't even stand up. My wife was so embarrassed, you know, and oh, God, the things I put the woman through is phenomenal. I'm so thankful that someplace she found some faith that kept her looking out after me. That last time that I was in Agnew, you see, after the first 30 days out there, before I tell you that, when I came in on Christmas night to the admitting office, the admitting doctor that had admitted me on four previous occasions took one look at me and said, my God, not you again. I said, yeah, doc, I'm your Christmas present. He didn't have a very good sense of humor, I'll tell you that for sure. But at the end of 30 days, I got drunk out there. I had a bad habit of getting drunk in these hospitals, and that was why I run out of them up north, because I'd get drunk and full of pills, and I'd just show off. And so I made the wet run over across the tracks from Agnew, and I got to, I think I had about 7/5 of Thunderbird. That was all I could get. I wasn't too choosy about what I got anyway, so I come back to the... I got drunk on Saturday, and I went back over on another wet run on Sunday, right across the tracks out in front of the joint. And I had a big old coat on, and I had about 7 of them fifths strapped around my middle, you know, big bulky coat. And I come back, and I was coming in the front there, and that little that street crossed the path that I was coming in. And she pulled right up there in front of me with her car, and she took one look at me, and she said, you're drunk again. And I sucked in my breath, and I said, who, me? Innocent as all get out, you know. And she said, you are, and I'm going to turn you in. I said, go ahead. I'll be gone by the time they get me. She said, they'll get you. Well, anyway, it come to a culmination there that I lost my ground privileges for a short time. We had to go to the doctor. I'm going to the doctor's office on Monday morning. And he said, what caused you to drink? I said, I was thirsty. I said, I've been kind of dissatisfied out here anyway. I don't like the ward you got me on. They had me on the geriatric ward, you know, and I was waiting on these wet brains out there. Guys like me that had gone too far. And they had to feed them, you know, and they slopped all over everything. You had to bathe them. I didn't like that work at all. reminded me too much of myself, I guess, when I got so helpless. So he said, well, why didn't you tell me you weren't satisfied? I said, oh, would you have paid any attention? He said, probably not. But he said, I will. He said, what do you do? I said, I'm a plumber by trade. He says, good, what you work in the plumbing shop? So they put me to work in the plumbing shop. And I never worked so hard in all my life. I never worked that hard on the outside. But the last 66 days that I was in there, I cut off everything that I was taking. I did not take anything to drink. I did not take any cough syrup. I did not take any pills. Now, that's rather odd, too, because I had a supply of both. I had supplies of all of it, the cough syrup, the pills, because I had a friend in the pharmacy, and he got all that stuff for me. And I had it stashed away so I could have taken anything that I wanted. There was people that was making the wet run every day coming back with booze. There was people with pot. There was people with needles out there. And by God, I didn't take nothing. And I don't know why. I did not want to stop drinking. There was no thought of it entered my mind. I was just trying to get out from underneath that wrap of 90 days that I had to do that I was committed for. Because my wife, you see, this was the fifth time she committed me out there. And that deputy sheriff down to the sheriff's office in the psychiatric division said, Mr. Farrar, I'm getting damn tired of you using Agnew for a drying out joint. He says, one more time and you're going to go out to Elmwood and I'm going to throw the key away on you. Well, I did not want to go to jail because I'd done jail time and I didn't like it at all. Those iron bars were hell. And so he said, well, you're going to have to watch your step. And he said, if I have my way this time when you go into court, you're going to go to Elmwood. And I thought, oh, my God, no. So I went before a board. And I'll tell you, they say alcoholics are great actors. We are. We're performers in case it's necessary. And I went into that board meeting, and the superintendent of the board and the superintendent of the hospital was the one that was asking me the questions. And I said, oh, Dr. Quernbaugh, I said, I'm a sick man. I said, I want to stay in this hospital, and I want to get well. Now, I'm gonna go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, I'm gonna quit drinking. I made him every promise in the world, you know, and so lo and behold, they let me stay at the hospital. I don't know how or why, but they did. And shortly after my troublesome time out there, I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings on Wednesday and Sunday nights. And inside of about two or three weeks, I was secretary of the men's group on the ward on Wednesday nights. And shortly after that, I was the secretary of the whole Alcoholics Anonymous program out there. And I followed that after I got out. Even I was very active in hospital institution work and went out there for about 10 to 12 years and working with the Hospital Institution Committee. And that doctor out there thought that I was one of the greatest people that ever walked. You know, he gave me complete, just blank coverage of the hospital. I'd go any place in any ward at that hospital grounds out there from the time that I got out until he left there. And I kept working, and I kept working. And I come out, and I went down, and I was a general secretary at the Downtown Fellowship in San Jose for over a year. I was secretary of two different groups in the first 6 months I'm sober. In a year, 6 months in one group, 6 months in another group, and a year at the Downtown Fellowship. So that was a year there and 2 years by the time I got through with the groups. So I had a good start at staying sober when I came out. People then told my wife and they told me that there was a change in me during that last 66 days out there. I didn't see it and I didn't feel it and I didn't know it, but my wife did. They kept telling her there's a change. And for some reason or other, she believed it. And she was as steadfast as anything, you know, about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she was out there for every meeting at Sunday night for the rest of the time I was out there. Now, I was supposed to go back to work a week. I would have to stay home for a week after I got out of the hospital. And she was working and couldn't keep track of me. So now here's the first indication there had been a turnaround. I asked the hospital to let me stay over for a week until it was time for me to go back to work. And they granted me the week's extension. I stayed a week over the time my commitment read. And I've thought back many, many times since I've been outside and in Alcoholics Anonymous, wondering just exactly what it took to turn me around. And to this day, I don't have the slightest indication of what happened. Unless I was never a religious man. I never went to church except as a kid going to Sunday school. I look at my clock once. I don't give a damn what time it is. I just want you to see I got a watch. I haven't had to soak it for over 21 years. I used to measure booze or diamonds by the... I had to measure booze by the carat instead of quartz. Because when I went out and didn't have my diamond ring on, I had it soaked someplace for a jug of wine. But when I came out of there and started doing this work outside, my wife was she got real proud. And I tell some stories about her once in a while that show you, it gives you some idea of what a damn phony I really was. About the fourth time she'd send me out there, she'd already called the people to take me back. And you know how the wife of an alcoholic looks. She looks like hell. She's dark circles under her eyes, and her face is drawn, and frowsy hair. She can't afford a hairdo. And so I know that she's sending me out, and I've got to have a belt, and I've got some stash. But I can't take a drink in front of her because she'll raise so much hell, the roof will blow off the house. So finally, the wheels start to turn, you know. And I got her real mad. Mad enough that she ran into this in the other room. And so real quickly, I went in. I took me a couple of belts. Then the other wheels started to turn. I went in the bathroom and I shaved. I put on a shirt and a necktie. And pretty soon, the attendants come and knock on the door, you know. So I went over and opened the door. And I said, "Come on in, fellas. She's right in there." Needless to say, they didn't take her. I went. But the kind of support that she gave me, you just, it's over and beyond the call of duty. And I can never, I always have to tell her how grateful I am in the meeting because I won't say a damn thing at home. But I have to tell her what a nice lady she is when I'm talking in these meetings. Except for one time we were in a great big meeting. Man, it was a monster, maybe 500 or more people. And I'm up here talking. I'm giving a hell of a talk. I know it is. I'm just going, you know, full blast. And all at once, everything went completely black. She's sitting right down in the front row. And I said, "Honey, what was I saying?" She says, "I don't know. I wasn't listening." You think that won't do something to your humility? Well, it did, and she keeps me pretty much in line. Soon after I got here and was staying sober, she got me a comb. About that long and about yay wide, she said, "Here's a comb for big-headed people." She comes up with all those little cuties, you know, every once in a while. And it's getting damn near time for me to quit, and I wanted to read this for you before I close down here. I have a little card here that I picked this up someplace in my travels, and I had some cards made up with it. But it was called the 12 Rewards of the 12-Step Program. 1, hope instead of desperation. 2, faith instead of despair. 3, courage instead of fear. 4, peace of mind instead of confusion. 5, self-respect instead of self-contempt. 6, self-confidence instead of helplessness. 7, the respect of others instead of their pity and contempt. 8, a clean conscience instead of a sense of guilt. 9, real friendships instead of loneliness. 10, a clean pattern of life instead of a purposeless existence. 11, the love and understanding of our families instead of their doubts and fears. 12, the freedom of a happy life instead of the bondage of an alcoholic obsession. The little phrase on the bottom says, the task ahead of us is never as great as the power behind us. I know that the power behind us is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I will now tell you one more story and shut up. This is a favorite of my wife. And Quint, you've heard it for 18 years, but you're going to hear it again. The Catholic priest and the Mormon bishop were flying cross-country on the Champagne flight. And the stewardess come down the aisle, and she handed the Catholic priest a glass of champagne. She reached back on the tray, got one, handed over to Mormon Bishop. He said, "Why, miss, I'd rather commit adultery than have that stuff pass my lips." Catholic priest said, "Miss, may I return mine? I didn't know we had a choice." Thank you all for being here. And before I close, may I ask my wife to stand up? Dorothy? There she is. Thank you very much.